a lack of U.S. leadership today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. The Trump administration plans to shut down the State Department's War Crimes Office. It was created to show other nations how to bring criminals to justice.
Now the message is, we don't really want to show you that anymore. We need to save $3 million or whatever it is per year.
Plus, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and his team in Moscow sure know how to troll the U.S.
They had a joke answering machine where it was like, if you want interference in your election, dial 3.
And we revisit the summer of love.
It's 1967, and you're playing with your little band in San Francisco, and in your rehearsal, hello, fellas, comes Paul McCartney.
Those stories all today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on a Friday. It's great to have you along with us. We start today with a look at two areas where the U.S. has historically been a global leader, but where today, under President Trump, leadership is in doubt. One is the ongoing push to keep reducing the number of HIV and AIDS cases worldwide. More on that in a few minutes. First, though, we're going to focus on Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's plans to restructure his own department, and that may include shutting down the Office of Global Criminal Justice. It supports war crimes investigations around the world. And we want to know what shutting it down would say about our country. Alan Ryan has a unique perspective on that. In the 1980s, he directed the Office of Special Investigations, a similar office at the Justice Department. It was the first war crimes office in the U.S. government, originally set up to prosecute former Nazis. Ryan says the two operations at Justice and State were designed to complement each other.
We were in charge of investigating and prosecuting war criminals. The State Department, through this Office of Global Criminal Justice, basically they were in a role of giving advice, support, guidance, financial assistance sometimes to countries that were trying to combat genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity. It was a very visible post, particularly under Stephen Rapp, who was the ambassador for a long time. And I think it's a very unfortunate step, because what it says to the world is the U.S. does not make war crimes and genocide and crimes against humanity, torture, a priority anymore.
In your role at the Justice Department trying to prosecute former Nazis, talk about your experience and what you felt the message it was sending to the rest of the world was.
Nazi criminals who came here after the war were mostly from Eastern Europe. Most of them were collaborators with Nazis during World War II. They came here. They lied about their past to get here. They were not investigated. There was no interest in pursuing these anti-communists, as they portrayed themselves, until the late 1970s, when Congress started looking into it, found that it was not just a handful, but a serious number, and told the Justice Department to do something about it, and created the office that I was the director of for several years. And that office actually continued until 7 or 8 years ago, and now it has morphed into the larger and broader Office of Human Rights Enforcement in the Department of Justice.
And the kind of message to former Nazis, did that go out to the rest of the world, that the United States is not, going to let this stuff just go, by the way?
It took us a long darn time to get there, from the end of the war until 1980. But we sent the message, I think, to the entire world that we would not look away any longer, that we would do something about this. And we did. We brought a number of prosecutions, nearly all of them successful. And that is what the office continues to do with its broader mandate now. It does work with the State Department's office, and I think one of the unfortunate aspects of what Secretary Tillerson has done is to essentially say, the Justice Department, you're on your own. But the Justice Department is a law enforcement agency. It doesn't have the same weight as an ambassador.
Is there an argument that in 2017 there are so many different types of war crimes and things that look like war crimes that make an office with such a singular mission and such a small budget kind of almost too small to deal with?
Well, there's certainly no shortage of war crimes or crimes against humanity, torture, enslavement, genocide. Those are going on all around us. And there are now many more resources that have been developed since the end of the Cold War to deal with them. And that was, I think, one of the contributions of the State Department, harnessing those resources very energetically and bringing them to the attention of NGOs and other governments. And that's, I think, what's going to suffer.
Are you hopeful at all that maybe Tillerson will turn around and say, you know, war crimes, crimes against humanity, this is the mission of the State Department. We're taking the whole thing on, and we're not just going to have a little office devoted to it.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I mean, he's made it pretty clear that the mission of the State Department is to advance American business abroad, and human rights is way back of the bus on that one.
Is there another part of the U.S. government that can take on fighting war crimes?
Well, the Justice Department is doing a very good job of it. But again, their mission is, like the FBI, to focus on crimes and to bring perpetrators to justice. That is as important now as it has ever been. No mistake about that. But what you lose in the loss of the State Department office is the profile, is the role of America as a leading voice in the world for human rights. And that's unfortunate.
Alan Ryan is a lawyer at Harvard University. He was the director of the Department of Justice's Office of Special Investigations in the 1980s. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Marco.
Here's another area where future U.S. leadership is in doubt: HIV/AIDS research and prevention. New HIV infections and deaths from AIDS continue to be a huge problem in parts of the globe. Next week, our Across Women's Lives team is heading to South Africa, a country deeply affected by HIV/AIDS, especially among young women. And that's not unique to South Africa. According to UNAIDS, the United Nations agency that focuses on HIV/AIDS, in all of sub-Saharan Africa, 3 out of 4 teenagers who become infected are girls. Michel Sidibe is the executive director of UNAIDS. We caught up with him in the middle of the 9th annual conference on HIV science in Paris. He started by telling me some good news about HIV and AIDS.
It is the first time that we can say that we have more people on treatment than people waiting for treatment. You have to remember that in 2003, we used to have 4% in need of treatment on treatment. And today we are saying to the world that we have almost 70% of people in need of treatment who are in treatment. So we changed completely the face of this epidemic.
So some good news there, obviously. Globally, more people on treatment than not. But also globally, there's been little change in the rate of new HIV infections among women in recent years. Why is that?
Is one of the most disturbing issues, because we are on track in many fronts, but we are off track when we talk about girls and women. They account for more than 59% of the total number of people living with HIV in Eastern and Southern Africa. The key issue is that we have not been able to really deal with the gender issues properly. First, the violence against women is a major problem. We have not been able to keep young girls at school. And particularly, we are seeing more and more young men who need to really be into the programs, and they are not knowing their status. And they become HIV positive and continuing to infect, which is not easy to deal with.
So what needs to change? Because since the onset of the epidemic, a lot of money has been pumped into the fight against HIV/AIDS. Have the funds just not targeted women enough?
What we need to do is to be able to work across issues, agendas, and make sure that we can connect dots. Just to give you one example, if you don't bring an education system into the picture, we know from the studies which we have been doing review in Botswana that any additional 1 year of schooling, you can reduce the impact of HIV by 11% amongst young girls. And we know that if we deal with economic issues like cash transfer in poor family setting, by giving $10 every month to the targeted poor family, to the young adolescent girls, you can really reduce the dropout by almost 40%. You can reduce early pregnancy, and you can reduce HIV infection by 35%. We need to continue to make sure that sexuality education becomes a reality every single place.
But isn't there already a lot of educational material out there telling people, you know, how to prevent this?
No, most of the material which are existing are not dealing with building skills. We're talking about knowledge on this disease, but building life skills, which will help you really to be able to negotiate when you are in a setting where the social construction will give advantage to young boy, to be able to confront that and to say, no, I will not have sex with you. because I personally feel that is not what I want, I am looking for. So we should work on sexuality education to equip young girls, young adolescents with skills and knowledge.
Just practically speaking, does a high rate of infection among young women suggest that men are not wearing condoms?
Is suggesting that men, first, are not wearing condom. Two, that men are not knowing their status. And when you don't know your status and you are continuing to have sexual intercourse, you just transmit. But the issue is also complex, Marco, because most of those young girls, they were really without social capital. They were taken hostage by their social status, coming from poor segment of the society. So that's why I said AIDS helped us to really better integrate those different dimensions.
Michel Sidibé is executive director of UNAIDS. He's in Paris at the 9th annual conference on HIV science. Mr. Sidibé, I know there's a lot going on for you today, so thanks for sharing a few minutes of your time
with us. Thank you, Marco. Thanks for your time.
Lots of news from Korea today. For starters, the U.S. State Department is planning to ban Americans from traveling to North Korea. Several U.S. citizens have been detained while visiting the country in recent years. One of them, Otto Warmbier, died last month after being held by North Korea for a year and a half. Also today, officials from North and South Korea were supposed to begin a new round of talks. That didn't happen. The venue was the DMZ, the demilitarized zone that separates the two Koreas. My BBC colleague Karen Allen was there.
Please now approach close to our rock soldiers and do not make any attempt to make conversation.
We've been brought by the UN to the demilitarized zone at Panmunjom. This is the closest we can get into North Korea. It is a neutral area, 2.5 miles dividing each side. In front of me, there are a mixture of UN and South Korean soldiers, and in the distance, a North Korean guard stands watch. We've been warned not to do any sudden gestures, not to try and attract the attention of any of the soldiers. Things are still extremely tense.
Please make a circle on this table.
We've been taken in by the UN to one of the main rooms with a large mahogany-looking table with leather seats around. This is where, in all likelihood, any future military talks will be held. In the past, generals representing South Korea have sat on the right-hand side, those from North Korea across on the left. The weight of history hangs heavy in the air. They've been using this room for decades.
Please not take any pictures while you're walking.
Being marched in a couple of military-style lines onto the next stage of the tour. Pretty regimented. Gives you an idea of the fact that this is the most militarized border in the world. Can I just get you to just tell me what we're looking at the moment in the distance here?
You're looking at the propaganda village of North Korea called Gijeongdong.
And we can see the flag, the North Korean flag, flying high above us. There's an equivalent behind the trees here in the South Korean village.
Yes, correct.
And then there are the infamous loudspeaker propaganda broadcasts that get blasted across the border in either direction. You just about make them out in the distance. Kim Joo-song, who's with me, defected 10 years ago. Little has changed, he says. They were on a constant war footing in North Korea, and they were primed to believe they would win.
I didn't think that war would break out. But I was told incessantly, and I was brainwashed into believing the war could break out at any moment, and we should be prepared all the time.
North Korean defector Kim Joo-sung, ending that report from the BBC's Karen Allen in the DMZ. Coming up, an Iranian fan remembers Linkin Park frontman Chester Bennington. You're with the world.
I like words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple. Jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. This shouldn't have happened. That's what the police chief in Minneapolis said yesterday about the death of Justine Damond. As you probably heard, Damond was the Australian woman living in Minnesota who was shot dead by a police officer there. Damon had called 911 herself to report a possible crime near her home. One of the officers who responded shot her through the open window of his cruiser. Most everything else in the case is still under investigation. Jared Goyette in Minneapolis has been reporting on the story for The Guardian. I know this was big news in Australia. How many Australian journalists have come to the Twin Cities to cover this, and what are they looking at? What are they asking?
I don't know if I have a full count, but it is a growing number, and they're taking up more and more space at the press conferences. It's at least six and more at this point, I'm sure. What they're asking is, I think there's a certain incredulousness that this has happened at all. They want to know, like, how could it be that two relatively inexperienced cops are sent out at night with guns into a scenario like this? They want to know how could this happen, and what does it say about American police and American gun culture? And just to contrast it with what local journalists have tended to approach the case differently, and that's something you see in the press conferences. Mm. The context here that's important to understand is we've gone through two straight years where a police shooting in the last two cases of an unarmed black man has dominated the headlines. The shooting of Philando Castile was the most traumatic and biggest story in Minnesota over the last year. And before that, there was the shooting of Jamar Clark. So the journalists here, this is kind of like, oh, well, we know this drill. And they tend to focus very specifically on the details of what happened in this case, whether the training changes that the police department have made have been enough. They tend to get very granular. And it's interesting to see the Australian journalists come in and wanting to ask those bigger questions. And on a side note, I don't know if are you familiar with the term Minnesota nice?
Well, I kind of can guess what it means, but yeah. So the nice, earnest kind of character of people of Minnesota.
Yeah, it's a it's a term that they're proud of around here, and I think that also reflects the tone of questions that journalists will tend to take. And you've had Australian journalists come in, understandably wanting answers, and not being afraid to ask it in a very direct and sometimes kind of confrontational way, or I've seen eyebrows raised and feet kind of shift uneasily as officials have tried to address those concerns.
Tell us a little bit about the victim, Justine Damon, herself. What have we learned about her since this happened?
She was almost universally beloved in her community. She was a yoga and meditation instructor. I managed to get a hold of a video that depicted a story that a lot of people told about her when I was asking, which was 3 weeks before she died, she managed to save a group of ducklings from a storm drain. And I think that's important because, she finds some ducklings, and within 2 minutes, she's, down in the sewer and sweeping them up with her dress and then, taking them to a safe place. She acted quickly. And unfortunately, I think some of that same proactiveness was on display the night that she died. When she heard a sound, she called the police, again, and then she went outside to see how she could help. But of course, there was a tragic outcome. But I think you can see some of similar threads in her personality and the way that she approached life.
Yeah, I've read similar things. Full disclosure, Jared, you used to work at The World, and this killing in Minnesota has all sorts of global connections, an Australian victim, a police officer with Somali roots. What struck you about the reach of this tragedy?
I guess it's worth noting that, in addition to interacting with, the international journalist here, I'm also working for editors in New York and editors in Sydney. And I guess one thing that struck me right away is that, we had international coverage of Philando Castile. That video of the moments after his death went viral, and it certainly made international headlines. What we didn't have was aggressive questioning by foreign journalists of what was taking place on a local level. And I think that is something new and something valuable.
Reporter Jared Goyette in Minneapolis, thank you for being with us, Jared.
Thank you.
Last week, we brought you the story of Siavash Sadlu, an Iranian who grew up listening to Linkin Park in Tehran. Siavash said Linkin Park's music had helped him get through his tough teenage years in Iran. And then yesterday, just 10 days after we told you that story, we got the terrible news that the rock band's lead singer, Chester Bennington, had died. He was found at his home in California. Apparently suicide was the cause of death.
I have cried a lot today, to be honest. And I think I'm going to find it really difficult to digest. You know, it's going to be pretty tough.
We wanted to check back in with Siavash.
I mean, everything from the past 12 years of my life just flashed before my eyes, and how Linkin Park's music has been connected to everything that has been going on in my life.
It starts with
I don't know why. It doesn't even matter how hard you try.
I was going to see them live for the first time in my life next week in Mansfield, Massachusetts, and so I was really excited, you know, about the concert. And for the past few years, I've been working on a memoir about my growing up in Iran, and one of the chapters in the memoir is about my late teenage years and how much we loved Linkin Park. And so I had this idea of giving the band, you know, that particular chapter from my book in progress. I was so close, you know, to see them live and meet the band, and I don't know, it just makes it more devastating.
Fly me up on a silver wing, past the black where the sirens sing.
I honestly hope that people won't, you know, judge him for taking his own life. I myself, as a teenager, had a suicide attempt, and I know what it feels like to be in that, you know, dark moment. I'm just sure that he felt like he could no longer go on, you know. Controlling. Can't seem to find myself again. My walls are closing in.
I'm convinced that it's just too much pressure to take.
I felt this way before. So insecure.
That was Siavash Sadlu, a writer here in Boston, sharing his thoughts about the loss of one of his idols, Chester Bennington, the lead singer of Linkin Park. He was speaking with the world's Shirin Jafari. Siavash wrote about this for our website, PRI.org. That's where you can also find some information about suicide prevention. Again, that's at PRI.org.
Against my will, I stand beside my own reflection. It's haunting how I can't see. Myself again, my walls are closing in.
Not a sense of confidence, I'm convinced that there's just too much pressure to take.
I'm Marco Werman. San Francisco, 1967, the summer of love. And South African musician Hugh Masekela was right in the thick of it.
Everybody was high.
Were you high?
Of course.
Did you try LSD in California?
I didn't try it. I took it. I took it regularly. Very few people were not tripping.
Revisiting the summer of love, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We know of at least three meetings between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump at the G20, but now we're hearing a rumor about a fourth meeting.
Maybe they went to a toilet together. That was a fourth time.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov there on NBC having a bit of fun at our expense. I'm going to have a hard time getting that image out of my mind. With me in the studio is the Washington Post Moscow bureau chief, David Filipov. I'm slowly getting acquainted with the Lavrov style. That comment now seems to be typical of how he's dealing with the U.S. under Trump, doesn't it?
Yeah, he's a real laugh riot. Back in April, they had a sort of joke answering machine where it's like, if you want interference in your election, dial 3. You know, that's kind of his thing,
well.
This deadpan kind of, you know, you're all out of your minds, you're all crazy, what's wrong with you? That's been their game.
Are we? I mean, does it seem to you that Americans are obsessed about the number of times Putin and Trump have met?
we have subjected the current president to an incredible amount of scrutiny because of the seeming favorable attitude towards Putin, because of these conflicts of interest that come out to the surface and are so blatant in some cases. So naturally, we in the United States are looking at all that very closely. From the Russian point of view, they're looking at the substance of the actual meeting. Some lawyers got together with some guys and talked about some stuff. What's your problem? And when you say that the Russians, well, our problem is lying about it, covering it up, potentially hiding something. What are you hiding? The act of hiding in the United States can be considered a crime. And the Russians look at you like, what is wrong with you?
Your Russian is strong enough, David, that you're grabbed as a pundit for Russian TV. When was the last time you were a guest on Russian TV and what were you talking about?
All right. I did it in March the last time. It's kind of a bad deal because you know how we have heavily favored liberal talk shows, conservative talk shows, Hannity, Maddow. You know, going on one of those when you're on the other side is a little bit of a suicide mission because you know you're going to get trashed. When you go on the Russian show, you're the token Westerner. You're the American. And everybody who's ever had a gripe about America can sound off on you like you represent the last five administrations of the United States. You know, they got a live one there, Washington Post, let's go. And I mean, I've had people yell at me about how Americans are fat. And I'm like, I'm 5'9", 160, baby. my body fat percentage is less than Pablo Sandoval's. You can't tell me that. But, you know, when you go on there, they are looking for anything that you can say that sort of starts to explain why Americans are so afraid of them. But when you're in the middle of the conversation, they jump down your throat. Oh, so you think it's that, eh? Oh, so you think the Soviet Union was bad, eh? You know, and you really kind of, you're up against it from the very beginning. You're backpedaling, kind of like you feel like Chris Matthews or Hannity or Tucker Carlson is chasing you down and there's nowhere to go. And your language isn't as precise as theirs.
You're American, David, but you've kind of had this relationship with Russia, been there and back since 1994. And now you see a lot of both places with the Washington Post. In the last several months since Trump took over the White House, what's your impression of how Americans view Russia?
By the way, I started going there in 1983. That's how old I am.
Correction.
you know, I remember going into a bar. 2012. Somebody said, what are you doing? You know, I was in Russia. Oh, yeah, Russia. Wow. Beers, vodka. Now, if you go into the same bar and say, so what do you think of Russia? Either the person will say, they got to stop meddling in our elections. It's terrible. And Trump's in there with it. Or you get this. You get, you know, the 60 million people who voted for Trump will say, the establishment's making a big deal out of it. They're just nitpicking. Hillary did far worse. So like that Russia word, without really any kind of deep sense of what Russia is or what it's about or even why it would be meddling, it already sets off this conversation and this kind of like already preformed positions that people have. Because depending on which side of the spectrum you're on, you see Russia either as a reason why Trump is dirty or a reason why the establishment won't let Trump work.
After the Berlin Wall came down about 25 years ago, all these journalists started going to Russia. Radio reports wouldn't stop playing the anthem, the international. Then Russia kind of fell to the back pages. The focus fell on Iraq and the Arab world. How do Russians feel now that they're back on the front pages? Is it unwanted publicity or a sign that Putin has taken them onto the world stage?
See, I can't answer any of your questions without telling a story. I have a guy who comes and fixes my Mac. And we joke about
in Moscow.
Yeah, in Moscow. And he's just a guy. He's a computer guy, just like anybody, right? And I've got to give him the password to get into the thing so he can be. And he's like, well, I don't know. Maybe I'll hack you. And I'm like, yeah, maybe you will. And he sort of stopped and he said, we're all amazed that you think we're so powerful. On the one sense, it's kind of cool that everybody thinks that Russians are omnipowerful. On the other sense, it's kind of terrible that everybody thinks that Russians are so powerful and then they want to use it for, like, I can't just be a computer guy. I have to be a Russian hacker, in your view. So there is this sense, yeah, we're back and we're bad and you can't stop us. But also the sense, why doesn't the world treat us like a regular country? And remember, Russians now have credit cards, they have jobs, they can travel overseas. And so the sense of why don't you accept us as just other people is something that's overwhelming, even if the Russian recognizes, yeah, we have a corrupt government. Yeah, there's one guy in power and we can't vote him out. But so what? Why do you think that we're hacking you? You know,
David Filipov with The Washington Post, their Moscow bureau chief. Thanks very much and enjoy your trip back.
Thank you.
Canada is promising to cut down on pollution to help combat global warming, but it also wants to ramp up its oil production and to ship more of it overseas. It's an awkward balancing act by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. We heard about that on the show yesterday. If you missed that story, you can check it out at PRI.org. But wait, before you listen to that, we're going to hear about one part of that plan to export more oil from Canada and how opposition to it is starting to spill over into the U.S. Here's reporter Eilish O'Neill from station KUOW in Seattle.
The Westridge Oil Terminal overlooks a finger of water that separates Vancouver from the deep green hills of the nearby provincial parks. It's where oil tankers come to fill up, at the terminus of the Trans Mountain Pipeline.
The pipeline is actually coming down through the trees on the other side of the tank there and comes straight out onto the dock.
Mike Davis is the director of marine affairs for Kinder Morgan. That's the company that owns the pipeline, which has been carrying oil here from the tar sands of Alberta for decades.
It's the Honda Civic of marine loading facilities. This is a very small facility.
Only about 60 tankers a year call at the terminal, but that could change soon. Kinder Morgan wants to build a second, much bigger pipeline here from Alberta. When it's done, tanker traffic would shoot up to about 400 a year, bound for California and Asia. Davis says that would relieve a big oil bottleneck.
Canada has the third largest reserves of petroleum in the world, and we currently today only have the ability to trade with one other country, which is the United States. And it's just good for Canada to be able to reach other markets.
Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau thinks so too. Trudeau's pledged big cuts in carbon pollution under the Paris Agreement to fight climate change. But he says building new pipelines would create jobs without busting Canada's carbon budget. But many people take issue with Trudeau's math and with his philosophy.
If you are planning to build two major pipelines from the dirtiest oil in the world, with nearly 2 million barrels of oil flying out of that place per day, you are not within the Paris climate agreements.
Paul Che Ogden-Wagner is a member of the Saanich Nation of British Columbia, whose homeland the new pipeline would pass through. Wagner lives in Seattle. He says he didn't actually pay much attention to the pipeline plan back in BC until some friends invited him to go with them to Standing Rock, North Dakota, last year. That's where other Native Americans were protesting another oil pipeline. He says he came back a changed man.
Coming home from Standing Rock was one of the biggest challenges I've ever had in my life. But they're all doing it for the protection of water, protection of their traditions, and for those future generations.
From Standing Rock to BC, make the land pipeline free!
After he got home, Wagner helped lead a four-day march along the waterway south of Vancouver that all those new oil tankers would ply. The protesters were marching in support of lawsuits against the new pipeline, and they were joined by about a dozen people from the U.S. side of the border, who were motivated by concern for Indigenous rights, climate change, and their own backyard.
We're looking out the window to the town of Victoria.
That's Victoria, B.C., in Canada. But Deborah Giles is standing in her office on San Juan Island, which is in Washington State. Giles works at the Center for Whale Research. She's worried about all those new tankers sailing through the narrow waterways shared by Washington, British Columbia, and pods of endangered orcas.
Noise is one thing.
Giles says ship noise can interfere with orcas' ability to find food and communicate. But she's also got a bigger worry.
The potential for oil spill is astronomically more scary. Because, yes, there's this crazy random border, but if oil gets spilled in Canada, it's not going to end at that imaginary border. It's going to decimate this entire ecosystem.
The marine ecosystem here stretches from Vancouver Island in Canada down to Seattle and Puget Sound in the U.S. and out to the Pacific. It's home to millions of people and invaluable marine resources. But Mike Davis of Kinder Morgan says the risks of an oil spill are exaggerated.
We've never had a release from a tanker loading in the 60-year-plus history of the operations here.
Of course, with a more than six-fold increase in traffic, the risk is considerably greater than it's been in the past. But Davis says Kinder Morgan's helping beef up spill response systems on the Canadian side of the border. Despite the possible impacts in the U.S., people like Deborah Giles don't have much say in whether or not the pipeline gets built. But BC's First Nations could influence the outcome, because the pipeline would pass through some of their traditional territories, including the home of Paul Che Ogden-Wagner Saanich Nation. And Wagner says they'll fight it.
They cannot trespass upon their land without those First Peoples saying, yes, you can do that. And so, you know, over 100 tribes have signed saying no pipelines will cross our borders.
First Nation legal challenges are working their way through Canada's courts, but even if they fail, Wagner says he's not giving up. He's ready to launch a Standing Rock-style protest in Canada. For The World, Alicia Neal, Seattle.
You're in a forest in Indonesia. This is what a forest really should sound like. Except all across the developing world, this sound is becoming more and more rare because forests continue to be chopped down at an alarming rate. And what's worse, the carbon released from those felled trees causes about 10% of the greenhouse gas emissions that are heating up our world. But there's some encouraging new research out today on a potential solution to the problem. Carolyn Beeler with our Environment Desk is with me in the studio to talk about it. Hey, Carolyn.
Hey, Marco. This is a pretty big deal because preventing deforestation, especially in developing countries, has been ID'd as a key way to slow down global warming. And developed countries are paying billions of dollars to developing countries to try to help them stop deforestation. But there are a lot of questions on how best to do this. And one of the reasons why is that people who live in and around the forests depend on timber for their livelihoods.
Right. I remember from your reporting in Indonesia not too long ago, where you recorded those forest sounds we just heard, you spoke with people who cut down trees to farm their land, for example, or they cut down trees to make money from the timber to pay for emergency medical expenses. So cutting trees is crucial in their lives.
That's right. And I reported on some pretty complex programs to try to get people to stop cutting down trees. But this new study that was just published today in Science magazine shows that a super simple program of simply paying landowners not to cut down the trees on their land, it works and it's cost effective. And they did that study in Western Uganda.
This doesn't sound like a radical idea. I assume it's been tried before. What's new about this study?
It's not a radical idea. Paying landowners not to cut down their trees has been going on for about 20 years. What's new is the way that this was studied. This is the first randomized trial of this, which means that the researchers could compare a group of people who were paid not to cut down their trees with a group of people who were not. And they found that it was cost effective, and it actually did incentivize people not to cut down their trees, people who likely would have done so without these payments.
Yeah, so how big a difference did these payments actually make?
So in the villages where people were paid not to cut down their trees, there was only about a 4% decrease in forested area over the study period, 2 years. And in the places where people just went on life as usual, there was about a 9% decrease in forested area. So 4% to 9%, pretty big difference.
Yeah. So how were the researchers able to evaluate whether this was more cost effective than just letting the villagers chop down their trees?
Well, over the 2 year period, they paid each landowner on average $113 not to chop down their trees. So when they compared that with this metric called the social cost of carbon, it was found to be an extremely cost-effective way to reduce greenhouse gas pollution.
So what could this study mean for the fight against global warming?
This is probably the most conclusive evidence so far showing that these direct payments to landowners do work and are cost effective. But as with just about any scientific study that we talk about, there are a lot of caveats. A big one here is that this was a 2 year program. It was quite small. So does it scale up and does it work in the long term, especially when you take into account enforcement costs? And enforcement can be really difficult in these rural forested areas.
The World's Carolyn Beeler from our Environment Desk. Thanks very much for telling us about this.
You're welcome, Marco.
The summer of 2017, 50 years on from 1967 and the so-called Summer of Love that bloomed in San Francisco.
Strobe lights beam, creates dreams. Walls move, minds do too. On a warm San Franciscan night.
This weekend, I'm hosting an hour-long special on the BBC World Service, looking back at that wild, revolutionary moment in the cultural and political life of America, and really the world. I met some fascinating people in San Francisco making this radio documentary for the BBC, and I want to share with you some of what they told me, because when you look around America and the world in 2017, it's hard not to think back about what a small community did to challenge the establishment 50 years ago. At the Haight-Ashbury annual street fair last month, I met a man who was thinking about all this. His name is Helger, and he was born in 1967. Helger's German, and he and his wife moved to the Bay Area for work about a decade ago. They loved it, and they stayed. I asked him whether the hype around the 50th anniversary of the Summer of Love is nostalgia or something else.
I mean, you know who the president is of the United States, and what we're seeing around the world, whether it's in Turkey or in other countries, that we see a movement of the democracy being abolished in some of the countries. And so I think it's important for us to go out again and connect to people in real life and try also to have a conversation. I mean, maybe we're a good example. We live here, and now we have friends from all over the world. So I think that's kind of the idea of what the kids tried here.
The real summer of love was not the summer of 1967, because they spent the year 1966 in a creative ferment in the hate.
That's Dennis McNally, former publicist for the Grateful Dead and a historian of the summer of love. The hate is Haight Ashbury, that San Francisco neighborhood where, as McNally says, the cultural life of America was fermenting.
They experimented with psychedelics, with consciousness, with sexuality, with music, with all kinds of things.
The ones doing the experimenting, an eclectic mix of artists and writers from Jerry Garcia and Gray Slick to Allen Ginsberg and Ken Kesey, folkies and jazz cats, actors and dancers, local business owners in the Haight, college kids and high school dropouts, and people who just wanted to be part of the scene.
And they had such a good time that at the end they said, let's throw a party.
The Haight Ashbury community has created the Council for a Summer of Love in San Francisco.
We call upon the world to help us celebrate the infinite...
A party that would last, in theory, for 3 months.
The council is calling for creative love happenings for every weekend throughout the summer.
The word spread fast. School was out, and the idea of being part of something exciting, radical, and fun drew as many as 100,000 people to the streets of Haight Ashbury that summer. Haight Street was constantly packed. Joel Selvin is a writer and former rock critic for the San Francisco Chronicle.
San Francisco was this glorious beacon of a new life, and it echoed throughout the world.
South African trumpeter Hugh Masekela had fled the apartheid regime back home and became part of the L.A. music scene. In June of 67, Masekela played the Monterey Pop Festival. Before he had his big 1968 hit, Grazin' in the Grass, he was grazin' in something else.
When you walk down the Haight Ashbury at any time, you know, it was difficult to find somebody who wasn't floating.
When you say everybody was floating in the Haight, what do you mean?
They were high. Everybody was high.
Were you high?
Of course.
Did you try LSD in California?
I didn't try it, I took it. I took it regularly. Very few people were not tripping.
Just imagine the freedom the Haight impressed on a young black artist from South Africa at the time. And remember what else was going on in the world. It was the Cold War, Vietnam was at full tilt, the civil rights movement had gripped America. If you want a clear sense of the mood in the country and the world back in 1967, listen to Harry Strauch. His family had emigrated to the Bay Area from Vienna, and he ended up in the Haight opening what was probably the first head shop in the U.S. in gear. But in between, he made a stop at Harvard, where he saw the schisms in America on full display.
I went to Harvard University, where Henry Kissinger and Timothy Leary were teaching, both at the same time in the same building where I was a philosophy librarian. And that was in Emerson Hall. And at each end of the building, there were two lecture halls. And sometimes I would go down to one, and there was Kissinger talking about realpolitik, and it was all loaded with these young future senator types. And then at the other end of the hall was Leary talking to the psychology graduate students, and they were all taking mushrooms with the prisoners in the state's prison system.
Yeah, kind of mind-blowing, but that image neatly sums up the 60s. There are so many legacies of the Summer of Love, but we've got to single out the music. 1967 was already a prolific musical year, and then the San Francisco sound caught fire. Here's one more excerpt from the documentary. It's writer Joel Selvin again with a great story about how Paul McCartney had to see the scene for himself.
He flew in from Los Angeles where he was doing some business, borrowed Frank Sinatra's Learjet, and spent the day and flew out without staying the night. He just wanted to come see San Francisco. He had a copy of Sgt. Pepper's, and it was a test pressing. And he walked in unannounced to a rehearsal by the Jefferson Airplane. Can you imagine that? Like, you're in 1967, and you're playing with your little band in San Francisco, and in your rehearsal, hello, fellas. comes Paul McCartney. Well, they knew what to do. They took him over to the airplane mansion and dosed him with DMT, which was a very cool designer psychedelic that was short term. It was like the trip was like an hour. Intense, you know. They called it working man's acid. And they sat around, and when everybody like came back to Earth, they listened to the test pressing, and you know, they didn't jam or anything, but you know. He wanted to see San Francisco. He wanted to see Jefferson Airplane. He'd heard about it. He'd made this record that sort of was an imagining of it. This was something happening, what, 8,000 miles away that he'd just heard about. It was a rumor.
C'est une maison bleue.
But it wasn't a rumor. It wasn't a dream. It was real. So real that musicians all over the world continued to fall under the spell of San Francisco for years to come.
Quand San Francisco s'embrûle, quand San Francisco s'allume, San Francisco.
A big shout out to producer Ruth Evans for making me a part of this documentary. You can hear the entire hour, if you're going to San Francisco, on the BBC World Service this weekend. And let me tell you how to listen. An app, one that you must download now because it's so darn cool, the BBC iPlayer. You can listen live to the World Service or any of the BBC's radio stations, not to mention the world's weekly sister program on the Beeb, Boston Calling. Yeah, Boston, you got yourself 43 million listeners every weekend. Just look for the BBC's pink iPlayer app wherever you download your apps. You'll be glad you did. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We'll see you all back here on Monday.
San Francisco se lève. San Francisco se lève. San Francisco. Où êtes-vous, Lise des Luc, Sylvia, attendez-moi. C'est une maison bleue, accrochée à ma mémoire, on y vient à pied, on ne frappe pas, ceux qui vivent là vont jeter la clé.
PRI, Public Radio International.